open up the Joint Ways and Means Committee Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is Thursday, April 21st, 2005. And what we are going to have today is a public hearing on Senate Bill 5517, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. With us today are four special honorary committeemen, committee persons. Why don't you introduce yourself for the record?
Okay. I'm Caleb Trisler.
I'm Corey Escobar.
Kevin Lynch.
Jonathan Mattis.
Thank you very much. We're glad to have you with us today. What we're going to do is continue with our discussion on Senate Bill 5517. And just so you committee members know, it's not always this vacant up here, but there's other issues going on around the building, and members will be filtering in as we proceed. So why don't we continue to move forward? Welcome, Satish, and welcome, Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where would you like to start off with, Mr. Chair?
Well, you know, we kind of went all over the board yesterday.
Yes, we did.
I have a feeling today is going to be a very quick meeting for us. Why don't we, if you have any comments, why don't we, from yesterday, you can share those with us, and then if not, we'll just move right into Satish.
But why don't we go ahead and move into to Satish, and we're circulating some information to answer some of your questions, and we could answer those afterwards if it worked.
Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Satish, why don't we go with you?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, including our honorary members. This is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services, and today I will be providing you with an overview of the Governor's recommended budget for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And you all should have my presentation handout in front of you. If you'll turn to page 2, you'll see two charts there. You've seen these charts a number of times. These charts show you the Governor's recommended budget for the entire Consumer and Business Services Program area, which consists of 17 state agencies, including the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The only thing different this time is that the Bureau of Labor and Industries is the only agency in this program area that has general fund. This agency has $20.9 million of total funds, which includes $11.6 million of general fund. Moving on to page 3, the functions of the Bureau of Labor and Industries support three of the Governor's budget principles, and these are the principles that relate to economic development, health and basic needs, and education and workforce development. And now in page 4, the chart on page 4 shows you the various fund types that make up this agency's budget. As you can see, general fund makes up 55% of the budget, and this agency's other fund budget consists of 27% is other funds, 7% is federal funds, and 11% of the budget consists of non-limited other funds, and that's for the wage security fund payments. Moving on to page 5, this shows the four program units that make up this agency's budget. The wage and hour division with 33.5 full-time equivalent positions is the largest program unit, which is 37% of the budget. The commissioner's office with 27.50 positions makes up 27% of the budget. The civil rights division with 30 positions makes up 22% of the budget. And lastly, the apprenticeship and training division with 18 positions makes up 13% of the budget. Moving on to page 6, this shows the various expenditure categories. As you can see, personal services makes up 67% of the budget, services and supplies 22%, special payments 11%, and capital outlays less than 1%. And this may be a good time to address an issue that Senator Morse raised yesterday about PERS and flex benefits being around 44% of the salaries. And the reason for this in this agency is because a number of the positions in this agency are salary range 23 or lower. That means the salaries are not that high. And when we have a lot of lower level positions, so the salary is not that high, because the flexible benefit amount is a fixed amount, the percentage would be higher. And another reason is also the pension obligation bonds. As you, for the 2003-2005, in the legislatively adopted budget, the pension obligation bond expenses were shown as part of state government service charges. They were shown as services and supplies. but during the execution phase, because of some federal issues and accounting issues, now they are being shown as personal services costs. And this also answers an issue that Representative Richardson had raised when we talked about the Employment Department, when he asked why the state government service charges budgets, why the 0305 estimates are lower than the legislatively approved budgets, because the pension obligation bonds, when in the legislatively approved budgets, they were shown as state government service charges, but during the execution phase, they had to be recorded as personal services expenses.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not understanding necessarily, Satish, how you're dealing with it, because the pension obligation bond is fixed, but the PERS charge is variable. So as you have higher income personnel, isn't that charge proportionally higher?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I think the main thing here is the flexible benefits, because in the governor's recommended budget, the flexible benefits amount is $771 right. per employee. So if we have a position that just makes $2,000, so when you compare it, it's a higher percentage of the salary. But if we have a lot of, like in a number of larger agencies, where we have a lot of positions that make much more, so there, the percentage sure. would be right. lower.
I agree.
So I think the main variable is the flexible benefits amount. Moving on to page 7, the table on page 7 shows you the budget for this agency by across biennium. And as you can see, the 05-07 governor's recommended budget is 6.9% higher than the 2003-2005 legislatively approved budget. If we break this down, personal services have increased by 13%, and services and supplies have gone down by 7%. Now, this budget includes $11.6 million of general fund. This is a 5.9% increase from the 2003-2005 legislatively approved budget. And the general fund does include reductions, as the commissioner mentioned yesterday. There's about a $222,000 of reduction because the agency voluntarily they reduced rent, and they've also done some other efficiencies. Moving on to the last page, the major policy issues we faced when developing the governor's budget. The governor's budget continues all existing services. It adds three positions, as we discussed yesterday. There's a position that's added to meet the business community's demand for training and education for technical assistance. This is a program representative two position, and the cost for this position is $137,000. There's also a position that has been added for prevailing wage rate investigations, and the cost for this position is $116,804 other funds. And there was testimony for the need for this position from one of the stakeholders yesterday. Lastly, in the governor's budget, there is an apprenticeship representative position that has been added. The agency has requested that this position be moved to the for prevailing wage investigations because of workload issues, and we support that. So unless you have any questions.
No questions? Senator Berger.
I don't think I have any questions, but Senator Johnson brought up the three positions and in terms of being able to justify those, and that legislators don't have an opportunity to really know sometimes what they've done. Is there any pushback at all from that on the part of the agency?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, certainly through performance measures and showing, I think her question was on the continued need. We'd showed the demonstrated need for it right now, but the continuation of that in bienniums in the future, and she talked about them being limited duration positions. I mean, my pushback on that would be simply, as Satish, stated just a few moments ago, most of our positions are pretty lower paid. As we talked about yesterday, a prevailing wage investigator is paid the same as a civil rights investigator or a wage and hour investigator. And given the nature of the work, I'm struggling to try and keep prevailing wage investigators within the prevailing wage unit and continue to keep those employees interested. If you make those a limited duration position, I think you'll end up adding already to the problem that I have of those folks looking if there's a position like a wage and hour investigator or civil rights investigator opening up, they're going to rather hurriedly run over to a permanent position than a limited, you know, duration position. These are not extremely highly paid positions, and I think that you would end up having employees looking for more permanent positions than one that's limited duration. However, there are certainly other things that we could do, like putting a budget note in to report back to the next legislative session on the continued need, and, you know, we could work on how to format that to demonstrate that continued need. You know, should it be there?
Follow up?
Okay.
Well, let's just take the third one, where you increase the number of apprentices, and it's particularly women and minorities used in public works projects. That's pretty easy to document. Also, if you fail to be able to accomplish that, you can also document why that failed. In other words, sometimes you're dealing with groups or agencies or so forth that you're trying to get to promote that, and that doesn't occur in that agency but isn't necessarily your fault. So, but there are documentations that I'm thinking of.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, clearly there are documentations we make in our performance measures. We have to clearly demonstrate, you know, if we don't meet our performance measures, you know, what the situation is within those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess part of my frustration on this, Mr. Commissioner, is I think we know the problem. Somehow I think we need to turn to you between now and round three to know what the solution is. And I'm not sure a budget note gets us there. And I'm not sure how you do it. To be very candid, I mean, it takes a special type of person who's inclined to that type of work, who feels more comfortable with a calculator than with interactivity with people.
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, if I could, one of the things, you know, when I came on as commissioner, one of the things that clearly was demonstrated to me within the prevailing wage rate unit was that the investigators we have and were very had limited background in the construction industry fields, which is what that unit deals with.
Mm-hmm.
What I've tried to do is bring in more people who do have that background. Now, there's a couple of difficulties in bringing in people with more of that kind of a background. One is that you have to, in order to meet the minimum qualifications, show that you have 2 years of investigative experience in some area. And most people who work in construction don't have that additional piece. Some do. And so we're trying to gear toward those people. The other thing is that clearly it's easier to attract people when the industry is down. But when the industry is up, you can make a heck of a lot more money out in the field.
Is there a way to do a job rotation?
We have worked on some job rotations, Mr. Chair, and we've worked on also using temporary positions for that to bring people in and try them out at so they have a feel for what they're really going to get into and see if that's really something they're geared toward. We're trying some of those innovations and clearly working with it.
Well, I think the message I received from the industry folks was they felt good with your work, but there was a level of frustration on that turnover, the same frustration you've expressed.
Absolutely.
And somehow I think between now and round three, for this committee's sake, it'd be good if maybe you folks could sit down and brainstorm an alternative that we can feel comfortable with.
Mr. Chair, if I might add. And Ed Talbot, for the record, Deputy Labor Commissioner. Jessica, who appeared yesterday as representative of AGC, is on our Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, which is does advise the commissioner, is made up of local governments. We're actually diversifying the membership further, as well as labor, as well as contractors. And I will tell you that they look at that money and how it's spent very seriously. They get the budget. They see how many staff we have, what our performance measures are. And if we're off track, they're going to tell us. And I'm sure she won't be shy in telling you as well. So, but I think we could commit to talking to the advisory committee and others and see if they could agree on some methods that would make you feel more comfortable that the positions are needed and that they're going to monitor their performance as a unit, as a whole.
Senator Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I am very excited always when we start out in these new sessions that something gets accomplished. And one of the things that I'd like to see is that the morale of our state employees is lifted. And we get into discussions For instance, in the PERS discussion and other discussions, where state employees actually are confronted in the grocery store and in other neighborhood settings and have shared with me how demoralizing it is for people who seem to think that they have the best of all worlds. You don't do your best job in that environment. And what I don't want is for people who are trying to work to feel like, well, I'm just going to be here a short period of time. What I would like to see is when you're doing a job that you simply document how we're doing. In other words, that we're doing better every week, and I think that probably you, just like other agencies, do that. And then when it comes time for the e-board or the next session, you have that documentation. I just think it's the approach that you take with people as to how well they're able to work and thrive in an environment. And so I caution you about that approach, that you lift the morale of the people that are working in your department.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I couldn't agree with you more. I try to do a number of things to make the employees feel appreciated. I agree with you. I mean, I know that one of the employees' concerns when I got rid of the commissioner's car was under the previous commissioner, he rarely ever used it. The employees would for technical assistance training, particularly when they went out into eastern Oregon or other places. They liked it because it was the unmarked car. It didn't have the E-plate. And the reason they liked it that way was because when you go out and do a training like that, and you start driving through a drive-thru at McDonald's or something, mm-hmm. you end up getting a complaint back to the agency about it. It's like, why are they using a state car? It's like, what, you wanted them to starve? You know? hey, they were out there for a training. They had to be there. They're on state business. It really is okay that they go through a McDonald's. But there are kind of that attitude at times, and we do get some complaints like that. That, you know, it's like if they understood what all was involved, people would be okay with it. We try to make sure and explain that. The other thing is, when units start performing better, I mean, we just started on new performance measures. When the prevailing wage unit got over their performance measure that, you know, they were struggling to get there, and we'd set a reasonable bar for them. It wasn't, super easy to meet. Absolutely. I send out emails congratulating them on those things and talking to them about it. I actually, one of my habits, which is maybe a little bit strange for some state agency heads, is I actually send out a birthday card to every single employee on their birthday, and one of the things I notate in there is how many years they've been with the agency, and, thank them for their service to the agency for those number of years. I also send them out, handwritten birthday cards every year. Takes me quite a while to do my birthday card list.
You don't do that for the legislature.
Actually, I do, Mr. Chair. You received one from me last year. It was handwritten. Believe me, my birthday card, our Christmas card list is now somewhere nearing 1,000, and it takes me about a week to do it all.
Actually, I did receive a Christmas card. Why don't we do this really quick? Do you scouts have any questions for the labor commissioner or for the committee?
No.
Now, what I want to share with you is my vote will be based upon your decision. Mr. Labor Commissioner, you're
going like
to the
candy?
Room. Why don't we do this? Why don't we excuse you, of course, so that way you can move on and go do what you'd like to do around the Capitol. Have you had a chance to tour the Gold Pioneer yet?
No.
All right. Well, there's better things to do than hang around here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can tell you, the scouts, that trip up to the Pioneer on the top of the roof is extremely interesting. Actually, as a former legislator myself, it's a great place to watch 4th of July fireworks from, too.
There you go.
Where are the scouts from, Mr. Chair?
From LeGrand.
From LeGrand.
Yes.
All right.
And,
very good.
We're very proud to have them here, and we want them to know that this is a citizen legislature. And which means that just folks from around Oregon come together and do their best to manage the state. And so when you read those ornery headlines in the paper, just remember that they're just average folks trying to run this place. So
wouldn't today's activities lead you to some kind of merit badge?
Well, I've taught citizenship in the community and the nation. And if you don't have those, you need to come visit with me, because there's about three requirements on there that I can sign off for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Have a great day at the Capitol.
Get you an extra patch.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Moms, for being scouts here.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's actually Annette could walk you through a couple of the questions you had yesterday regarding the private employment agencies, I believe was one, and another was on performance measures.
Right.
Mr. Chair, members, you should have a packet. It looks like this on the front page. The actual front page is an answer to a question that we got in an earlier appearance about how did the staff break down in the various priority categories where we had our priority list and what was in the commissioner's office versus what was in the administrative support unit. So that's the answer to that question. And if anybody has any further, you know, questions on how that breaks down, we'd be glad to discuss it with them. The next chart on what is Appendix 8 is just a required report that Robin and Nelitho asked us to do on the vacancy report. So it shows you our vacancy report and the status of those positions and the reasons for the vacancy. And then the third piece is what was asked for yesterday, I hope, is a question and answer from what you had yesterday. And the first one, and I'll just briefly go through them, and then if any individual member has additional questions, we can meet with them personally or direct questions from the committee as well. Our private employment agency, which rated relatively low on the priority list, and we have very little work currently on that, is something where we right now only regulate a very small slice of those agencies that are applicant fee paid. So individuals who are job seekers that go to these agencies, they're looking for a job for themselves. And if they're paying the fee, as opposed to the employer who might be searching for someone who pays the fee for them, then we regulate that as a consumer protection aspect so that individuals looking for jobs who are often obviously don't have a lot of resources if they're unemployed aren't somehow disadvantaged and taken advantage of in the market for those agencies. So we have statutory direction to have those agencies obtain a bond and provide basic consumer information to the individuals who are using their services. If there's a complaint, we can investigate, make sure that they weren't overcharged or that there was not some kind of misrepresentation on the job that the individual was seeking. And we get very few complaints under that law every year. And our role, like I say, has diminished. We used to actually license prior to 1997 all private employment agencies, which we call PEAs. It's slightly different than what DCBS does, which I believe was the chair's question. DCBS regulates an entity called a leasing, worker leasing companies. Those are the kinds of things where one business may need to expand but doesn't want to hire their own staff. So they go out and take usually a handful or more, sometimes hundreds of employees, and those employees still work for the worker leasing company. They never actually go to work for the company who's using their services at the moment, unlike someone who goes to a private employment agency, gets a job, and works for that new employer for which the agency got them the job. So that's the distinction. Primarily, it is my understanding, because I worked on this leasing issue when I worked for the Employment Department as well, that is a workers' comp unemployment insurance reason why they regulate that industry, because some businesses were trying to sort of ditch a bad workers' comp rating or a bad unemployment insurance rating by leasing workers. And so it became an uneven playing field for employers. So the state began to regulate in that area. So that's the primary difference.
Does it make sense? How much heartburn would you have just in terms of streamlining if that was sent over to those folks and put under that umbrella? Or vice versa.
The worker leasing company.
Now we have heartburn.
Yeah. Sure. The worker leasing company is really based on, like I say, on a workers' comp issue, so I'm not sure that it really belongs with Foley. I think that would be a disconnect.
Okay.
We can certainly chat with DCBS about whether or not they think regulating a private employment agency is something that would fit better in their portfolio.
It's a small little
it's
thing.
It's so small.
It's like two complaints a year, Mr. Chair. It's very, very tiny.
The reason I asked that is earlier in the session, we had an entity come before us, and I just laid into this entity saying, I have no clue what you do, what you're doing. And later on, the entity said, that's not my job. That's the other entity that we assumed. And that's when it clicked with me as chair. If I had no clue what the difference was, the person out on the street is going to have no clue. And granted, this is a very little step, but I wonder if there's just a way in terms of streamlining to put those two together. Well, it even makes a difference.
Mr. Chair, as Annette said, we'd be happy to sit down with DCBS and, you know, discuss if that's a proper fit and, you know, which way to go. It is an absolute minuscule. It's probably one of the very smallest things that the Bureau does.
If you wouldn't mind at least just making the phone call.
Sure.
And please note, from my perspective, it's just a streamlining issue.
Mr. Chair, the next question was in regards to a reference, which we believe we found in the budget document, was at $1.7 million in wages that you had referred to. If we're correctly identified, the reference you made, it was in our governor's recommended budget, page 150E. That was the amount that the prevailing wage unit had collected on behalf of workers after an investigation and our investigations are conducted in response to complaints. So after an investigation, if their wages due that we find as a result of that investigation, we will collect those wages on behalf of those workers and pay them to the workers. So in 2001-03, the agency investigated 403 PWR claims, and as a result of those investigations, we collected $1.7 million in wages for workers that should have been paid that amount.
Okay.
We also have other wage collections that we do as a result of our general wage claim process for non-PWR claims. If people are owed wages, they think they file a complaint with us, and we investigate. And again, if we find wages due that the employer should have paid, we will collect those wages on behalf.
Do you file a lien on the company and on the people?
We can once we get a judgment. We have a whole judgment unit that registers judgments.
I would strongly encourage you to talk with the Department of Revenue.
They're our first line of collection.
I would have a communication with them, the Department of Revenue, the Treasurer, the Secretary of State, and our General Government Ways and Means Committee is getting ready to move a committee policy bill that's going to enhance state collections by doing a reporting requirement to the three big credit agencies prior to judgments. So if you have someone who has a delinquency, you'll have the ability to report it, and therefore these companies, before they go out and buy their new Lexus, will have to take care of their issue with the state before someone's going to extend them credit. And we also think there's going to be a tremendous amount of additional revenue that will be generated by this and brought into the state. So I'd encourage you to at least have the conversation to see if it applies.
Well, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that. I'm glad to see that happening as one who served on a committee where we talked about collections and what was owed the state over a number of years in the 01 session, and where we allowed private collection companies to be more involved. Matter of fact, one of the things we've tried innovatively with the housing department is one of our, for an unlicensed farm labor camp, the fines for that goes into a fund for the housing department for constructing new farm labor camps. We passed that over to them, and one of the things we looked at in the last year was they wanted to know if collections through Department of Revenue was quick enough. We usually gave them about 90 days, I believe it was, to collect, and then looked at a private collection agency, and one of the things that we did with them was said, okay, they wanted to try and make it 30 days. We worked cooperatively and have made it that way and see if the experiment works in operating things faster. Anything for collections of owed debts or wages, we're very much intrigued with.
Perfect. Just very quickly before we proceed forward, what I have it on my mind, Representative Richardson, Representative Avakian, Senator Carter, Senator Westland, and Senator Johnson are all excused today for other business in the building. So just wanted to make sure we had that on the record. Why don't we continue?
Fair enough.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson yesterday had asked a question in regards to looking at our charts and graphs here, where, certainly a fair question where the commissioner and I weren't with the Bureau in 1995, but we have examined the workload that's been associated with these, particularly civil rights and wage and hour division, and the caseload that's associated with them. So I've attached to this question and answer the documents that we submitted to the Audits Committee in regards to our performance measures, and I have noted that for Representative Richardson, and I'd be glad to go speak with him individually, that and our civil rights investigators now have close to 270 cases of biennium per investigator that they investigate, which is quite a significant caseload, and we have started to gather information on how that looks in regards to other states and like the federal government investigators, and it appears that that is a higher workload, and so I'd be glad to chat with Representative Richardson about that.
What's the average amount of time on a case?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I wish there was such a thing as an average.
Just ballpark.
It would tremendously vary depending on the type of case. I mean, you know, from a prevailing wage investigative standpoint, if you've got one contractor who worked 1,000 hours and the question is the 100 hours that they used as a carpenter's wage versus an iron worker's wage, that investigation would take a very short period of time.
Meaning
that you could, you know, if you get the certified payroll, which that's the big question, that's why we're working on Senate Bill 477 in order to increase that period of time, then you could have it done easily within 60 to 90 days from the point that you got the complaint. Then you went and tried to get the certified payroll. That takes time to get it back. You could easily close that thing in somewhere between 30 to 90 days.
And I act shocked on this. And please don't take it as a commentary. That's quick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I don't know the industry. I don't know the timeline. That is quick.
But, you know, when you have a massive project, the one I use as a prime example is always the Coos Bay Pipeline Project, because it is the largest PWR investigation in the history of the Bureau. That one has been ongoing for well over a year.
And so just so I'm clear on this, sorry, I want to understand caseload here. So you could have a person with an average of 270 cases who could have one 30 to 60 days or one that's ongoing. And everything in between.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
It depends on the flow of the information that you're getting. I mean, usually it's trying to get the information in.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now, do you want to add to the civil rights side of things?
Yeah, that caseload, for the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the civil rights administrator. I believe that the numbers, it may be comparable in wage and hour, but the 270 figure is actually civil rights caseload per biennium. And by most of our cases, we have to complete within a year. What we're trying to get our staff to do is complete the majority of their cases within 6 months. Sometimes that's impossible with caseloads. And then we also have contract cases. The City of Portland, OSHA has a case with us, but other local entities have cases, have contracts with us, and we have to complete those cases within 90 days. And those often really present a burden on investigators that have caseloads. They vary right now. They average right now per investigator, just the ongoing that they have in their caseload right now, averaging it out, it's about 60 per investigator. And the files are like this. We have some investigators that have 90, one of them has 92, and that's not due to performance problems. She ended up getting, she speaks Spanish, and we got OSHA complaints. There were 18 companion files that she got in one day.
60 cases per investigator open at any one time.
Right, right. They generally close about 120 to 135 per year. And they get assigned last month in intake. We had a really heavy month in intake, and we opened 253 cases. And that was assigned out and averaged out to about 18 new cases per investigator. We expect an investigator to conduct the initial interview with a complainant within the first 30 days of having that complaint. We're also sending out letters to the respondent, and it's easier to do the interview if you've got the respondent's position statement, which we give 2 weeks, but frequently they can't get back to us in time, so it pushes the initial, which is the performance measure, so it's really tough to always meet those standards.
Well, and I assume attorneys can get involved, and the next thing you know, we could drag for a long time.
Well, and Mr. Chair, from the civil rights side, what we try to do in the process is, you have to understand, through the number of complaints that we have, only about 10% are found for cause, to actually, you know, have cause. I mean, others can, you know, we may think there is, but there's not enough, there's not enough information, there's not enough proof or whatever. But those 10%, they next go to the next level. And our big goal, and one of the things Amy's worked on as an initiative, is to radically increase the use of conciliation. What we try to do is bring both parties together and work something out before, hopefully attorneys aren't involved at that level, but they can be, and to try and settle those so they don't end up then going on to the courts.
How does a caseworker manage? That's some serious juggling.
It is a lot of juggling. And I can tell you, it's interesting being in the agency at night. You know, there's times I'm there 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, and some of those investigators are even working evenings because that's the best time to get that return phone call back to an individual who's either a complainant or a witness in a particular case. So they have an interesting time with it.
I would imagine it's in everyone's interest to get these things done as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, one of the things when I was talking to Representative Richardson yesterday, we were talking about, whether the effect is on the actual individual, whether it be the complainant or the respondent, the employer or the employee, is that this really can be a traumatic thing that you're going through from either side. Mm-hmm. And the sooner it's settled out, quite frankly, the easier on all parties concerned. So it is our goal to advance those. And one of the things I was telling Representative Richardson yesterday was that as the investigators and the number of investigators goes down, the amount of time it takes to get some of these to conclusion advances closer and closer to that one-year time frame.
Can you do this for me? And I'm just trying to get a handle on caseload. Okay, there's
sure.
Can you put together a chart for me with three columns? On one column is a light caseload, a simple case, a medium case, and the difficult case, and just kind of share with me the workload factors that go into each of those. And my motivation purely is this. I just want to understand what goes into them.
Well, and Mr. Chair, you have to understand that we have three different types of investigation. I shouldn't say types of investigations, three different divisions that do investigations. The wage and hour, there's straight wage and hour claims, which is wages, perhaps minimum wage, meals and rest periods, those sorts of things. You can have the prevailing wage investigations, which are those on a PWR project, or civil rights investigations. But civil rights investigations can be of any type, from an accommodations issue to onward. So we can give you a flavor for it. I think if Jessica Harris was here today, she might be able to enlighten you. When she had a bill in earlier this session about advancing, the time frame for prevailing wage investigations, we actually brought her in the office and said, "You see this rack of books here? That's the Ford's Bridges investigation."
Well, I guess
and
my take on this issue is if you're on the side of labor, this is a great labor rights issue. If you're on the side of business, this is a great business issue.
Well,
I mean, both sides have an interest in getting this thing right.
Both sides have an interest, but even on the prevailing wage side, Mr. Chair, I would argue that it's not only a great thing for labor and the employee getting the right wages. It's an argument of fairness. The honest contractor who is really following by the book, who doesn't get the bid because someone else, is cutting corners and cutting edges and not completely following the law, is getting severely disadvantaged as well.
Well, I'd share with you, I'm open to the issue.
Okay.
I would like to see, again, just kind of three columns to help me understand.
We can work that out.
Can we proceed forward?
No, I think that's fine. I wish that they could work themselves out of one kind of job, which is civil rights, and that everybody would just know the laws and know the rules and obey them, And then you could take your time and spend it on other things that would be just as helpful. But unfortunately, that doesn't sound like, from what the numbers that they've given me, that's what's happening. But I do think that as long as we've had civil rights laws, I believe it's 30 years, is that about right?
40.
That we are either slow learners or we are, some people try to use the system. And apparently you eliminate those and cut them down to the real 10% of those. But even that takes all of their time processing fraudulent claims, and that's too bad.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I would wholeheartedly agree with you. I would hope for a day that we really wouldn't run into civil rights violations, but I can tell you from reading cases, even prior to my own time, we were discussing a prior case that actually shocked me a while back, and it was, I don't remember whether it was a McDonald's or a Burger King, where we actually, under Commissioner Roberts, fined the employer for failing to serve a person because they were a person of color. And my first question was, where in the state did that happen? And you know, the answer was in the Lloyd Center District, 5 blocks from our office. And I was in shock. But those really do happen out there. There are those slow learners. The other thing I'd mention to you, too, is that remember that we are a less costly administrative process that actually affords quicker investigations for both the employer and the employee than the remedy of the courts, which is a much more costly way to go. And it takes a lot longer. So,
well, my only other comment, and Dan will probably be amused by this because I've expressed this to him before, is that he remembers that this is the labor commissioner and industry. So I kind of emphasize that and industry side, because being in business, I want that balance. That's in all very seriousness. That we always try to level the playing field, and for people that are creating and hiring and risking their money to create jobs. So we don't want to hurt our people that are putting their name out there and taking a lot of risk financially.
I want to add to that just really quick, and then I'd appreciate your comments on this. How do you handle issues where you're dealing with just a lack of understanding of culture? I have a lot of good folks in my district who still today would call you honey and sweetie, and how do you deal with that?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm Amy Clare, Civil Rights Administrator, and I have to say, my background was as an advocate, and coming into this, the investigators and everyone else gave me a quick going through that we are a neutral law enforcement agency, and that is really really, really clear in how we do our work. We do not take sides. And that 10%, once we made a cause finding, we do take sides and try to resolve the issue. We still try to get a no-fault settlement, but our staff is really clear on that and feels very passionate about being neutral. In terms of sometimes we get cases like you had mentioned where somebody makes a comment that could be taken as sex harassment.
Harassment? Mm-hmm. You're the young kid down there.
It has to be ongoing and pervasive or be so significant that before we would make a cause finding on that. The sex harassment cases where we go cause, unless it's ongoing, are really egregious. I was shocked at what still goes on in this state. And a lot of times it's in rural areas. It's young women that don't know how to speak out for themselves or are afraid to, and you'd be appalled.
Mm-hmm. How do you balance the enforcement versus the education, if you will?
Well, Mr. Chair, the education, you know, enforcement is, you know, in the case of Civil Rights Division, is through the Civil Rights Division. We are solely a complaint-driven agency. We don't go out there and find cases in any way, shape, or form. And all they do is investigate. On the technical assistance side, through the technical assistance unit, we put out publications on civil rights. There is a booklet that we put out on it.
Let me step back. Walk me through. I'm a 70-year-old cowboy from Eastern Oregon serving on a board, and every time I speak to you, I call you honey. and you take exception and say, I've had enough of that, and by the way, I don't like the way he votes on this. So, how do you
well,
handle that?
Well, Mr. Chair, as one who, you know, if I step away from the Bureau and as one who comes from a completely and utterly male-dominated profession that's not exactly known for its timely, you know, over time niceties and sensitivities toward women, as one who, when I went through my apprenticeship class was the first one that ever had women in it, I can tell you that I have seen an amazing change in the building and construction trades. I mean, when I first started with the building and construction trades, I can tell you, yes, it is true that there really were boxes and job trailers with magazines that would not be appropriate in this building and are no longer appropriate on job sites. Right. And, you know, there were things hanging in trailers. There were slogans. I mean, I remember being in a construction trailer where the slogan that was hung up was, sexual harassment won't be tolerated in this area, it'll be graded. I mean, you know, which was a joke that went on around there. But in time, I think over time, what we've done, and particularly through the apprenticeship and training classes, is tried to do more diversity training and more sensitivity toward, you know, the reality.
Specifically, is how would you handle me as a 70-year-old male who now has a complaint, who every in public, well, I mean, this isn't a behind the scenes, this is in public.
Oh. That is not egregious. That is not offensive. I can tell you that I have signed the denial of someone's claim in a form of a final order in a particular case. I mean, you have to remember how our agency operates. Most of the cases Amy deals with, I don't see unless it gets to the point of final order, because I am the final arbiter after the administrative law judge makes a recommendation. I don't get involved in the early on part. That's ex parte communication. So what happens at the end is I did sign one where it was a male complaining of sexual harassment of his female employee because of some of her jokes and purportedly pinching his behind and a couple other things. And we denied it. It was, you know, there just wasn't enough to it. There was nothing egregious, nor was there a demonstration on his particular part that he found it offensive. And
that's critical.
We have denied it because you have to be able to say, hey, I told you it's offensive. We've made a point to the employee. I've asked you to change it, and it continues.
So you use common sense.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I mean, some of the cases, to give you a flavor of some of them, there was one that was a while back particularly egregious where the employer continued to put pornography on the female employee's screen. There were constant emails on her email, not his, constantly, because what he seemed to do was use her computer in the evening and constantly do it, and it would just float up her email, and she talked to him on numerous occasions, documented by many other employees, was, you know, warned, asked not to do it time and time and time again. He continued to do it, and even in a more pervasive form, and how he reacted to her about her complaint was completely egregious, and we did find for cause in that case. I did sign a final order fining him. And that, you know, that's the level it has to reach to get to that point.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the only thing left, I think, on the question and answers was just Representative Richardson had asked us, you know, how did we choose to re-examine and make more realistic and focused our performance measures? And so I went back to the performance measures that the prior administration had used, and they, in the measures for civil rights and wage and hour, had only been meeting one out of eight of their targets. So that was a pretty good clue for us when we came on board in 2003 that something was seriously wrong with where their targets were set, what were realistic, and we readjusted those And the majority of the problem was that they were no longer realistic because of the staff reductions and the rising caseload. So I'd be glad to chat individually, as I said, with Representative Richardson to make sure he's aware of that. And finally, the other question that you had asked us, Mr. Chair, at the end was our willingness to work with you on training new business owners on their responsibilities when they hire their first employee. And as I noted yesterday, we had already committed with other departments to do that, and we're more than willing to work with you and the other departments to come up with that type of training that's succinct and sort of gives them the lay of the land about what they need to be aware of, and then when they need to come back for specific questions, they know who to call.
Well, I just think there's a real opportunity for one of you statewide electeds to take off in stimulating the state's economy. I'm just waiting for which one of you is going to do it.
Fair enough, Mr. Chair. That's one quick other thing, if I might be able to comment a little bit on Senator Verger's comment earlier about the Bureau being both the Bureau of Labor and Industries. You know, I actually absolutely agree with Senator Verger about that, that, you know, from our investigative standpoint, we have to take a fair and balanced approach. From our apprenticeship and training side, what we deal with is joint apprenticeship and training committees, joint business and labor. You know, and I think that if you talk to a lot of the interest groups that we deal with, you'll see that, you know, over a period of time, even though I will openly admit my first year was a little rough, that, you know, we really have tried to work more with the interest groups, tremendously more this session. And I can tell you, as an employer of 106 individuals, you have to understand my workforce, half of them are attorneys. They all know a great deal about labor law. I understand even more so than I did before when I managed construction workers, the challenges that employers face in dealing with employment situations.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, could I take advantage of something? Since the natural gas line is in my district and is up now to looks like $1 million, that might be more costly than people had anticipated. I am curious on your suggestion of the responsible bidder form that would be signed. It's Senate Bill 1006 that was to be heard today but was not heard and has been sent back to committee. Would in any way that particular action of some kind of form being signed and sent to the Bureau of Labor and Industries have interfered or prevented a company with a shady past from being hired?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, first of all, I want to be real clear, that was not my bill.
Is this the same bill we were talking about yesterday?
It is exactly the same bill that Senator Morris was talking about yesterday,
right,
that belongs to the construction and building trade.
All right, I did not have...
And,
okay.
Unfortunately,
they've changed that bill.
Yeah,
so
they have. Would it have done something in the Coos Bay pipeline project? You know, I think part of the problem you see in construction and building trades, or in construction and from a public contracting standpoint, I should say, is that we need really to have a central repository of information on a particular contract that makes it more accessible to the local governments. In the Coos Bay pipeline project, that it would be the Coos County Commissioners, that they have a central repository to be able to gain information on a contract when they've got complaints. And one of the things you'll find in our prevailing wage booklet, for instance, is those contractors that we bar. Those are the ones that reach that level. The question is, what about the contractors who've had, you know, a number of DEQ complaints, a number of employment complaints, a number of Department of Revenue for failure to pay taxes or employment taxes or any of those? How do we gain and gather all that information and have it at one central spot for those local commissioners or city councilors who are mostly, you know, in a lot of cases around the state, part-time, low-paid or no-paid employees, totally volunteer, to be able to help them make that decision? That particular bill, in my opinion, would move a little bit closer toward what I'm describing. It wouldn't have done it in totality, but I think it would have been of benefit to do so.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm just kind of searching for a way to prevent ever having that happen
who
to someone else
issue,
in Oregon. I'm
in terms of the state of Oregon, who took the lead on that?
On which one, the Coos Bay?
Yeah.
Well, As far as who was the contracting agency, Mr. Chair, it would have been the Coos County Commissioners.
Yes,
they were the ones who actually let it out for bid.
It was the acceptance of a low bid.
But the legislature did an appropriation, if I remember.
$20 million.
And ran it. They must have ran it straight through DAS, or was there a department that took the lead on that?
The funding flowed through the Economic Development Department.
And I just look at the fact that there's $1 million here. It was $1 million mistake. And so, and I think the people making the decision were just totally conscientious in trying to do the frugal, accountable thing. What they didn't know hurt them. And I guess it's very difficult to maybe give you a list of people that you shouldn't do business with, but maybe there should be some kind of 5-star list, a 4-star, or a 3-star, meaning these are the best people. These people have the best records somehow, so that and it's not an interesting thing. I think it's a sad thing, is that I went to a meeting in Portland shortly after they were hired, and people in the trades profession were telling me it was a mistake. And it was before anyone even realized it was a mistake, their reputation had preceded them. People already knew about this company. It wasn't a secret among people in the profession. So I guess that's the only thing that I've tried to think of is how you can avoid that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I clearly agree with you. I mean, there was some concerns. I mean, I did have some earlier involvement prior to letting that job for contracting conversations about whether it was or was not a prevailing wage project. So I did talk to a couple of the Coos County commissioners about different issues, and there was some concerns, certainly, about the contractor was Mastic out of Florida, and about their other actions in other states.
Right.
And it was commonly known, but the problem was that there was no central repository of information for the commissioners to look at in order for them to say whether that was a responsible contractor or not. And they were worried about, I mean, the county commissioners, I certainly understand where they're at. They're worried if they don't take the lowest bid, they can be sued. They're worried if they do take the lowest bid, is the person responsible or should they go to the next one up? Clearly, in this situation, in the end result, the only way you found out is, unfortunately, through a lot of hard knocks, that they would have been better to move up. And I guess, what I'd love to see is let me give you one example. ODOT does a pre-qualification for contractors process, but that's only for ODOT projects, and I'm not familiar with every aspect of how they go about doing that, but they do pre-qualify contractors. It's kind of your, 2-star, 3-star, 5-star kind of list. But that's only for those types of projects. It doesn't relate then to the next level of saying, here's what we do on building projects, here's what we do on projects like a gas pipeline or the like.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're in a position of cooperating with, as your balance of labor in industries is there. On the other hand, you're also in a position of protecting people from people who are not good business people. I mean, there's an awful lot of just good business that goes on in the state of Oregon every day, and you never hear anything about them at your agency. And the employees are treated fairly, the employees treat the employer fairly, and that goes on. And so obviously you have to intervene where people do not uphold the kind of bargains that they're supposed to uphold. But it does concern me in this low bidder process, because having been in local government for quite a long time, I was right there voting many times on what we were going to do as far as bids were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And you are trying to take the very best. It's other people's money that you're spending. And so if you're conscientious, you want to be sure that you spend that wisely. And so that's where it is. But the responsible bidder, that's kind of a new term for me. That's come in, I don't know how long it's been around, but it's a new term somewhat for me. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that term has been around for a long time, and it's always been an argument about where do you define it, how do you define it, what are the triggers that you look at.
Okay.
And I, even as a legislator, I put in different bills over the years to try and mm-hmm. better define it. You know, the balance is really hard to find. Where do you, I mean, every employer out there, particularly in the building and construction trades, has at some time had some sort of a problem where, you know, someone made a complaint about something, you know, or they were late with a payment to the employment department. You don't want to get them off the responsible list because of one or two, you know, things that happen. I mean, no matter how great the employer is and how decent they are, the employees, if you've had enough employees over a period of time, sooner or later, something's going to happen, justified or unjustified, to make a complaint. Whether it's a lawsuit or a complaint with us, it's just part of doing business. I mean, trust me, I've had a few against me as an employer at the agency. So it does happen. But you got to balance that against the one who's always in trouble, you know, and clearly has set a pattern and practice of trying to undercut their competitors by balancing the books on, basically, it's probably not a polite way to say it, but cheating their employees. Mm-hmm. And
I have one more area I want to discuss, and then probably wrap it up for today, and then we'll get to round three here eventually, I guess. What pieces of legislation do you see coming that moving forward through the system that you're going to need to have passed?
Mr. Chair, actually, as far as pieces of legislation that we're going to need to have passed, there's a number of things that we have in the system, and one of the things I've really tried to do this session is make it easier for legislators. I had an interesting conversation with former Senator Vern Duncan, who's a former, you know, superintendent of public education, and we were talking about the balance between being a legislator and being an administrator, and how actually having both of those can help you at one or the other, depending on which one you go to first. But one of the things we try to do is, with our briefing book, is to try and lay it out to legislators easy. Here's the key contact people. We have every piece of legislation that we've got in there. We have everything from simple things like getting rid of the reference for noon for minors, those under the age of 18, having their lunch breaks at noon. Believe it or not, 80-some-odd years ago, they put that into the law. We don't enforce on it. I don't really, you know, for instance, a minor may work different shift, different hours. They don't need to take a lunch break at noon. The law clearly says that if you work an 8-hour shift, they get 30 minutes unbroken, relieved of all duties, no earlier than the third hour, no later than the fifth. That's fine for everybody. That's what we enforce on. Why not eliminate that? We do everything from that minor to trying to, you know, do some other things, like trying to clear up a statute so that it clearly states in statute on the Oregon Family Leave Act that there's court cases, and it puts clarity to the law so employers can clearly read it, employees can clearly read it. There's not a whole lot that we have out there that's of a fiscal nature. There are some pieces of legislation other people have that may affect us from an FTE or a dollar standpoint. I don't know if that answers your question. I'm trying.
Well, it does. The one thing I want to share is, you know, this is a partnership. We're all in it together. And there's a House Policy Committee with a chairman there that we just need to make sure that we all work together. And I'd encourage you to go visit with him and make sure that we're all working together.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that. I can tell you it's an interesting standpoint for being an administrative head that one of the things, particularly the Budget Committee from last session, charged us with was trying to find ways to be less general fund dependent. However, when we, you know, there's only a certain ways you can go ahead and do that. And we were trying to.
I don't mean that.
Sorry.
Good. Sorry to interrupt.
Fair enough. But when we try to do that from a policy committee standpoint, you run into other problems as well. So it's kind of an interesting balance that you try to find between, you know, how do you become less general fund dependent, but yet where does that fund come from in order to do it? So we're always trying to find an interesting balance to those types of approaches.
Well, just, I guess, between now and round three, let's just make sure we're all working together and making sure that the policy folks are on board with the Ways and Means folks.
Fair enough, Mr. Chair. We'll do our best to make sure that's coordinated.
Mr. Chair, how do we interact a little bit better with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, with the Oregon Economic Development Commission?
Yeah.
The members of the commission. I'm not that familiar with who they are or how their terms are staggered, but I just want to kind of put that thought back out. I had mentioned to Director Gardner, I do think the more, I know that during this session you've made a lot of effort to remove duplications of services with little scattered things happening in several different places, right, and trying to get it into one. And I think this is a place where people that are involved with labor, industry, regulatory need to have their voice heard in the process of the development of jobs.
Good point. Mm-hmm. Very good point. Just to kind of give you an update, is our committee has been working with the Department of Economic and Community Development to try and figure out, you know, what's the optimal way to provide services to those who are trying to help stimulate the economy. And we're really trying to bring in as many folks as we can into that discussion. And there are several components, and obviously workforce and regulation play into that. And I think we're going to need to bring the Labor Commissioner in, especially in the interim, when we try and sit down and really flush through those details. And I think we'd all want to.
And I saw one other, the Office of Minorities and Women,
right,
would be another voice on that board where you're trying to
right,
do those.
That's exactly right. We're working with several people who represent other segments of the workforce, including minorities and women. And also, this is very interesting, committee, I had a meeting with a group of disabled entrepreneurs. And so we're trying to make sure that we're all working together in a cohesive manner. And I shared earlier today that I brought a poor fellow up here and just laid into him, and he said, not my issue. Well, he was part of Women, Minorities, and Emerging Small Business within Consumer and Business Services. I had mistaken him with that exact same agency in economic development.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And this poor fellow, I mean, I'm just taking it to him. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's like, well, you know, I don't do a lot of outreach. And I'm like, well, why aren't you doing outreach? Just lay it in. And finally, he looks at me, not my job. Anyway, and I think part of what we need to do, especially in the civil rights arena, is have a better understanding of how do we create opportunity for all Oregonians to do business in the state of Oregon. And you folks are a key part of that. And I think you're exactly right. We need to have you at the table as we take a look and have that discussion of how do we make sure all Oregonians have a right to do business in the state of Oregon and have the same opportunity as you and me.
Well, Mr. Chair, I couldn't agree with you more. I certainly agree with Senator Berger that there are ways that we can work better in economic development and workforce development and apprenticeship and try and match those pieces together. And whatever we can do to help and assist in that process, we're more than willing, ready, and able to do.
Well, what I would share is we're really trying to take the best ideas that we can find. And Senator Berger kind of brought this now to the forefront. I hadn't made that connection yet. And so maybe we need to start thinking through that and maybe have a meeting with a group of us in the commission and with the commissioner.
I've seen that. Just to give you just an example of that is the Fair Board,
mm-hmm,
which has been predominantly agriculture, And now the Oregon Fair, State Fair, is very diversified. So times change and things change, and so commissions and boards need to react to that, and the legislature needs to react to that so that we do things better.
I'm very open to that.
Absolutely. Fair enough.
So where do you want to go, committee? Is there any other information you want to...
I believe that you were talking about some public testimony. I think there was...
Is there anyone out in the public who would like to share public testimony with us? We have our witness registration, and I think you did such a capable job that you covered all...
I scared them all off.
You scared them all off. Do you know any good apprenticeship jokes that we can share?
Not that I would tell on the microphone, Mr. Chair.
There you go. Well, we appreciate you coming before us, and this committee has worked very, very well together, and we appreciate you coming here and being part of this, and we're all in this together, and we all need to work together and find solutions that will work for not only... the Bureau of Labor and Industry, but also for the legislature. And I think if we just keep working together, we'll get there.
Thank you.
Unless there's any disagreement, I think we're going to adjourn.
All right.